Thank you to the five of you who clapped. That's very, very kind. Very kind of you. Yes, I've been married actually for 10 and a half years now. So it wasn't only the case that apps were just sort of the seed of a dream. Actually, iPhones didn't even exist when I met my wife. They came out in 2007, which is the same year I got married. And the truth is, Sianne, she couldn't be with us tonight because she's looking after the kids, but she's a lot more attractive than I am. So I'm actually very grateful that the apps didn't exist, because I think in a wider marketplace, I wouldn't have fared so well. So I'm the last generation of men who are able to punch above their weight, I think. So this question, can love survive the dating apocalypse? It's really exercised my mind a lot over the last for a long time, to be honest, but in preparation for this. And partly through force of habit, because I'm a preacher by trade. It's my business. It's what I do. We have a church, and I speak every Sunday. I'd like to start with a couple of verses from the Bible. I'm not assuming that you're all Christians, so don't worry. But this is from a book which, when I was studying Hebrew with a friend of mine who's Jewish, in London, he told me that they're not allowed to read this book to boys under the age of about 14. And it begins in this way. It says, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine, and your anointing oils are fragrant. Your name is oil poured out, and therefore virgins love you. Draw me after you. Let us run. The king has brought me into his chambers." And it spills on for page after page in a love poem, an erotic poem, actually, a celebration of desire and of marital bliss in some senses. And I say that to you because I think it's important to remember that the yearning for love and for sexual union is as old as the hills. It goes all the way back to our deepest, darkest past. But something obviously has changed in recent times. This is where the term dating apocalypse comes in. It came from an article that was put out in Vanity Fair a year or two back, and written by a lady called Nancy Jo Sales, called Tinder and the Dawn of the Dating Apocalypse. And she quotes a man in there called Justin Garcia, a researcher, who said, "We're in uncharted territory when it comes to Tinder, etc." He says, "There have been two major transitions in heterosexual mating in the last 4 million years. The agricultural revolution, when we became less migratory and more settled, and the rise of the internet." Now, whether he's right or not, it's up for us to discuss, to debate, I don't know. But one thing is absolutely certain, is that we're seeing some massive transitions and changes on the whole scene of how people relate to each other in love or in sex. And some of the ways that that's captured is by the speed. It's one area of which people hook up today. The hookup culture is becoming the norm, and the fact that you can be in bed with somebody within minutes of contacting them is becoming status quo. There's also the change in culture in terms of what's acceptable, in terms of what is expected, in terms of what's normal. Been a massive shift, even in the last 10 years, and since I was at university and thinking to what it's like now, there has been an enormous shift in that area. And also just what you can put as sort of volume, the number of partners and dates that people can experience these days has exploded. And it's quite normal for people to have, three or four partners a week in some contexts where you're very active on these kinds of things. So it's into that world that we need to think and ask this question: can love survive the dating apocalypse? What's happening in the scene? Can you get through this whole scene and arrive on the other end happily settled with somebody who you love for the rest of your life? It seems to me that in the midst of all this change, there's massive fallout as well. In the Nancy Jo Sales article, she quoted a kind of wistful desire that people have. You know, one person said, "Sometimes you still catch feelings." I thought it was such an interesting way to put it, you know, that sex is the normal thing, but sometimes you catch feelings, how the world's flipped these things around. And you may yourself feel that you desire a deeper connection with someone that could last you through life. You may feel that if you've engaged in the whole scene, you may feel that you've suffered something of the use and the objectification and being discarded that so often accompanies the world of dating these days and has become the norm by which we engage with one another, men and women, in both directions. And of course, at the sharpest end of this is the feeling of loneliness, isn't it? Which drives us to search for love and to search for settled love that can last us for life. So we're asking, can love survive? And I think that it's a vital question. I think that there's an image of what love looks like that resonates with every heart. The picture of, for example, of, and I've met couples like this, couples who've been married for 50, 60 years and who remain faithful to each other. And so often it's the case, isn't it, that when a couple have, when their lives have become so deeply bound together for that kind of length of time, that when one dies, the other dies within days or weeks because they've lost a part of their very self. And you think, that is love, isn't it? There's something very beautiful about that, something that everyone resonates with and desires. Back in the 90s when I was a teenager, I remember there was a novel which a lot of people were enjoying and raving about, and it was called Captain Corelli's Mandolin. I think it's the only romantic book I've ever read in my life, to my shame. And there's a quote in there which was read at a lot of weddings, and it goes like this: love is a temporary madness. It erupts like volcanoes and then subsides. And when it subsides, you have to make a decision. You have to work out whether your roots have so entwined together that it's inconceivable that you should ever part, because that is what love is. Love is not breathlessness. It's not excitement. It's not just being in love, which any fool can do. Love itself is what's left over when being in love has burned away, and this is both an art and a fortunate accident. Now, obviously, it struck a nerve with a lot of people, the people particularly who are tying the knot. So on that note, I want us to kind of dig into this subject. And I want to basically approach it in three areas. I want to think about apps, I want to think about sex, and I want to think about love. I'm going to move fairly rapidly because I have far too much to say, and I want to leave time for questions at the end. And that's why you have pen and paper on your seats. How do apps change the game then? Let's start there. Let's think about apps. I don't think technology is bad. I'm not a technophobe in any sense. And of course, I have friends who have met and married and been settled having connected online. So please don't mishear anything of what I'm going to say. But it's important that we look at that level before we dig a little bit deeper. And I have a number of reservations about the whole world of apps, and unsurprisingly. And let me just give them to you. The first is, we're confronted by the massive problem these days of options. It's called the paralysis of choice. There was an article in The Guardian not so long back called Why Too Much Choice is Stressing Us Out. And it talked about how Tesco's as a supermarket is beginning to change its whole strategy. They used to offer 28 different varieties of tomato ketchup. And of course, they're losing a huge market share to Lidl and Aldi. Aldi have one brand of tomato ketchup. So they offered 228 variations on air fresheners. And Aldi offered 12, and the author says, well, 11, that's still 11 too many for me. But of course, the problem is, when we're confronted in life with a plethora of options, it creates a kind of anxiety about choosing, and then a dissatisfaction when you have chosen. And all of us have experienced this. I remember as a kid when, when on the odd occasion when we would get a takeaway, we used to get it from the Chinese takeaway, which is at the bottom of our road. And we were pretty much creatures of habit. We used to order the same things every time as well. And I was content with that. Most little boys are. And now I find it quite challenging to order a takeaway because I have to select between two or three apps on my phone and then cycle through the ratings and likely delivery times and all the reviews of these different restaurants. And then when it comes, I'm usually disappointed because I'm thinking I should have ordered from the other place. And I found it's true going on holiday as well. You remember when you were young, you used to go on holiday, and if you were going to go out for dinner, you used to walk into whatever town you were near and find the nearest open restaurant and walk in and eat whatever they were serving. And now we spend 3 or 4 hours a day on TripAdvisor, cycling through options until we narrow it down. We can afford restaurant number 3 in the area. So you ring and you try and book a seat. You realize it's fully booked. And so you have to settle for number 10. You go, you eat the food. You realize that every other reviewer in TripAdvisor has no idea what good food tastes like. And you go home absolutely disappointed, don't you? And this is the problem that the world has created with an increase of options. You think we'd be happier, but actually the very reverse is true. And this plays into the whole dating game. Years of experience in pastoral ministry has told me that the biggest problem most people have is the challenge of committing. And it's not because they don't want to commit to someone. It's because of the anxiety that nags at the back of the mind that there might be someone better out there. And one of my biggest jobs as a pastor is usually just to give guys a kick up the backside and tell them, just get on with it. Because sometimes it's just that anxiety that fuels the, do I love her, don't I love her? And I tell you what, this actually predates the advent of apps. And what I'm trying to say to you is, of course, that this has poured fuel on the fire and fed this anxiety over choice and options. Now, when people are considering who they should settle down with, the scale of the decision with the possibility of the range of options out there makes it very difficult and breeds discontentment in the heart. And this is not just something I'm theorizing. This can be measured in how sociologists have researched this and have read into these things. So there's a problem of options. And there's also the problem of shallowness. So there are basically a couple of ways, broadly speaking, to fall in love, aren't there? There's the fast way, when you see someone and you tumble head over heels in attraction to them. And eventually, in getting to know them, you realize that it forms into something more real over time. But it starts with attraction, it starts with chemistry, it starts with a spark. And the other way is a slow way, where you get to know somebody over time, and then eventually you wake up one day and you realize that you're thinking about them all the time, and something's developed in your heart that you didn't expect. And of course, I'm not saying that one way is better than the other. But and if I'm honest with you, I was more the first way, actually. I remember the day I clapped eyes on my wife, and it was instant attraction. I thought she was absolutely beautiful, and I still do, just to assure you. I still do. But, of course, physical attraction is one-dimensional, and it's insufficient, isn't it, to sustain love. There's a verse in the book of Proverbs, an ancient wisdom book in the Bible, that says, charm is deceitful and beauty is vain or weightless or futile. It says, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. In other words, somebody who has substance and righteousness and character that you can depend upon in life. And I think the problem then with the modern scene, obviously, is that it fronts the shallowest aspects of who we are. And you can imagine, how do you present yourself accurately through a few words and a picture? It seems to me a little bit like the problem of trying to communicate what a smell is like to someone who's never smelled it. You can vaguely use words that might describe it. Or have you ever tried to buy perfume online? would you ever do that without smelling it first? Only the stupidest of husbands would do that, right? Because you don't really know it. You can't go by a description. It's very hard to describe. Now, if that's true of a smell, how much more is that true of human personality? And it seems to me that the more that we filter our interactions through ones and zeros, essentially, through the internet, the more that we are becoming controlled by the shallowness of that world. It goes both ways, that there are a lot of people who you would skip over online, who in real life you would have a very real chance of finding a spark with because of the way they laugh or the way they tell a joke or the things they're interested in. And other people who you think on the face of it, you think they're incredibly interesting. We read the same books, or we watch the same Netflix box sets. Well, who doesn't? But, and I'm attracted to them. And then as soon as you meet them, it's like when you smell a bad smell. You instantly are repulsed, and you realize, I could never marry this person. So there's a problem of options, there's a problem of shallowness, there's also, friends, the problem of money. I don't know if you thought about this, but apps are businesses. And if you think about how these businesses work in other areas of your life, think about the other apps on your phone. Most of them are built on the premise that the more time you spend on them, the the more money they make, whether in advertising or data and these kinds of things. They need your attention. So it's not in the interest of an app-making business to get rid of its customers by those customers exiting the market satisfied, or in other words, happily partnered up with somebody. Now, I'm not accusing them of being scoundrels, I don't know, but it's possible, isn't it, that a world which is geared towards profit-making is not necessarily the world which is geared towards finding happy and a settled love for the rest of your life. But friends, I don't want to stay on the theme of apps, because I actually don't think apps are the problem. I actually think apps are the least interesting aspect of the question that we're thinking about tonight. And we need to think a little bit about what's gone on underneath the surface. And that's why I want to talk to you now a little bit about sex. This is where we can start to discern some of the massive underlying cultural change that's taken place in the West in the last in recent decades. So much so that you can very easily chart, as you go through successive generations back in time, the number of sexual partners that your parents had, and then your grandparents had, and then your great-grandparents have. And there's a linear connection between which generation and how many sexual partners they've had. And that's, of course, no surprise to any of us. We know the world we live in, don't we? And there's been a steady increase. And this is what gives rise to comments like this. This was from the Nancy Josel's article, interviewing one of the guys, young guys she was talking to. He says, I hooked up with three girls, thanks to the internet off of Tinder, in the course of four nights, and I spent a total of $80 on all three girls, he says proudly. He goes on to describe each date, one of which, he says, began with the young woman asking him on Tinder to come over and smoke weed and watch a movie. I know what that means, he says, grinning. We talk for a total of maybe 10 to 15 minutes, he says. We hook up. Afterwards, she goes, oh my God, I swear I wasn't going to have sex with you. And I was like, well, you did a pretty shitty job of that one. And she just relays story after story of this kind of thing, of the quick, fast, instant world of hooking up that exists now in the world at large. And the question I'm interested in is why? Well, what changed? How did this come about? Have you asked that? There's a book that came out last year by a sociologist who researches sexual behavior called Mark Regnerus. And the book is entitled Cheap Sex. It's not a moral statement. It's because he views sex as an economic thing. He understands it this way, that sex used to be very expensive in the sense that very often it resulted in having a baby. And therefore, you didn't enter into this thing lightly. And one of the cultural sort of tsunamis that kind of transformed the world was the advent of contraception, and particularly of the pill, which he says cheapened, economically speaking, the value of sex, because having sex no longer means procreation. That pleasure is disconnected now from responsibility. And of course, it devalues sex, that it becomes just a physical act. And I think he's obviously onto something. There's definitely a connection that you can discern there. The way we actually think about sex has changed. We don't realize it, but you realize that if you step back 70 years or 80 years before the pill was around, people thought about sex differently. They understood its power in a different way, particularly the power to make babies. And I agree, but I also think that there are deep shifts in how we understand sex that have to do with the onset of secularism. Back in 1996, there was a group of philosophers called the Spice Girls who sang a song that goes like this. It says, are you as good as I remember, baby? Get it on, because tonight is the night when two become one. I need some love like I never needed love before. I want to make love to your baby. I had a little love, now I'm back for more. I want to make love to your baby. Set your spirit free. It's the only way to be. R-O-Wow, R-O-Wow. There's a line in there. There's a line in there, believe it or not, that actually sums up the Christian view of sex that's as old as the Bible itself. It's from the very first pages of the Bible. It says, tonight is the night when two become one. That sex was understood to have a binding power to join souls. to actually join you to another person in a spiritual way. That's how Christians understand sex. And so the Spice Girls probably didn't know what they were singing, but they were too profound for their own good. I actually think 3 years later in 1999, Bloodhound Gang caught the spirit of the age more accurately. And the change that's happened in the way we think about sex when they sang these immortal lines, "You and me, baby, ain't nothing but mammals, so let's do it like they do on the Discovery Channel." Now, of course, in a world that has been disenchanted, where we don't believe in spirits or gods or anything of the kind, we are just physical products. Of course, the idea that it is a mammalian act is now the norm for the way we think about it. It's just a pleasurable act. But I have a few reasons that I want to push back. Partly, of course, because I'm a Christian and I do believe in God. I do believe in these things. But also I want you to, you know, I'm going to try and speak to you at a level that I think you may agree with me. Here's my first point on this. I think sex is way more powerful than we'll admit. Most people, I've had lengthy discussions with friends who are not Christians about this, about whether there is such a thing as no strings attached sex. It's even the terminology that's used, that people use on apps, is NSA, you know, just interested in no strings attached sex. And the reason why I doubt that it's even there is even such a thing, that sex is far more powerful than we'll admit, well, I have lots of reasons, but think about these. There are still very powerful taboos that exist around sex acts, particularly ones that cross age boundaries. To have sex with somebody who's underage is considered inappropriate, but if it was a purely physical act, why would that be the case? It seems somewhat arbitrary to me. Think about this as well. The issue of consent that's blown up in the media recently and is destroying so many careers, tarnishing so many names, and rightly. But if it's just a physical act, why? You know, I agree that forced sex of any form is a heinous thing. Would you ever say to the victim of sexual abuse that it was just no strings attached? You know, why are you so upset? Clearly there's something more going on here. Or to put it the other way, do you think that consent neutralizes the power of sex and makes it a safe thing to do? Does it make it a meaningless thing or a weakened thing if you just offer consent? I can't see how that works. Think about also the power of jealousy. Most people, you know, it was very interesting actually when I was discussing this with a married couple who are friends of ours but are not Christians, and we were talking about sex, and they were saying, no, there's such a thing as meaningless sex. And then he said, and the husband started to say, yeah, I remember when before I was married to her, and you know, and she, the wife, immediately shut him down. Because the power of jealousy is very hard to overcome. Why should you overcome it, in fact? The Killers, I think, captured it brilliantly in their song, Mr. Brightside. I'm just going to keep quoting songs at you tonight. I promise this is the last one. They said, "Now I'm falling asleep and she's calling a cab, while he's having a smoke and she's taking a drag. And now they're going to bed and my stomach is sick and it's all in my head, but she's touching his chest now. And he takes off her dress now. Let me go. I just can't look. It's killing me and taking control. Jealousy." And actually, when I hear that song, it actually makes my stomach turn. Because as a married man, there's an appropriateness to the feeling of jealousy. In fact, it's one of the most powerful agents to protect the sanctity of the marriage union. It's a good thing. But jealousy makes no sense in a world where sex is meaningless or is no strings attached. And what about the experiences of regret? I think there are very, very few people who engage in the current hookup scene who don't experience any regret at all. I think it's quite hard to escape feelings of regret. But why would you feel regret if it is purely a physical act? And so I'll leave that with you to think about, but I think sex is more powerful than we'll admit. Here's another thing I would say to you. This is where we're getting into some slightly risky territory, so bear with me. But easy sex benefits men more than it does women. I know there's a lot of people these days who try and deny the differences between men and women and say that they label those differences as gender essentialism. But of course, all the research, empirical research, tells you that these differences are real and do exist. And that, of course, we can't say that they're true of every individual, but when you speak in generalisms, there are truths that are true of populations as a whole, that you can say, this is true of men and this is true of women. And when it comes to sex, what the sociologists have discovered, and it's beyond question, is that there are these kinds of differences in the way men and women approach the sex act. Men are more drawn to physical pleasure of sex. They initiate sex more than women. They fantasize about sex more. They masturbate more. They're more sexually permissive. They'll take greater risks to have sex, so they'll risk their job, their marriage, and all kinds of things, their reputation, their family. And they'll feel less hurt by the rejection that they experience by being discarded after having had sex. Women, on the other hand, are more drawn to what is described as the affirmation of desirability. So it's less about the physical pleasure, and though obviously that is a part, but more about the feeling of being desired. It has more to do with the expression and reception of love, that there is more of the validation of worth involved in the sex act, that it's more about fostering and reinforcing relationship commitment, that they tend to go for longer periods without sex, they take far fewer risks to have sex, and they're more likely to regret one-night stands, and there is a much lower interest in casual sex with a stranger. And one of the sort of proofs, which just sort of, I think, is really nails this home, of the differences between men and women's views of sex, is that Regnerus, in his book Cheap Sex, says this. He says, women never pay for sex. He says, across multiple data sets over many years, I have still not witnessed a female respondent who claims to have paid for sex. That's just a very interesting insight into female psychology in opposition to men's, isn't it? Now, why does this matter? Why would I go out on a limb here, making a point about the differences between men and women? And it's because of this. Because it means that the modern dating world favors men profoundly. Men are getting what they want without the responsibility that used to go with it. And meanwhile, women are giving away their power because generally, in society, women are understood to be the gatekeepers of sex, but getting very little in return. And the way Regnerus describes this, he calls it, in a very memorable phrase, the collapsed cartel of women. A cartel, if you don't know what a cartel means, a cartel is, let's say there were three companies in London who were importing Blue Mountain Jamaican coffee, famed for its beautiful aroma and light, refreshing taste. Nutty flavors. If those three companies compete with each other to offer the coffee at the lowest price so they get the most customers, eventually they'll end up with zero profits, and all of them will be struggling and potentially go bankrupt. But if the three business owners get their heads together and say, "Listen, we're going to agree not to drop the price below £40 per kilogram of Blue Mountain coffee," and they agree that, some kind of agreement, then all of them are winners. They all make a profit. And Regnerus says the way the collapsed cartel has worked for women is that there used to be a social pressure among women to be chaste and to keep the cost of sex high. And men would have to make firm commitments to take responsibility if they were to have a woman, essentially. But now, and of course, this is no way to blame women. Please don't mishear what I'm saying in any way. What I'm rather trying to say is that the situation we now have favors men because, as a rule, they get what they want. And women are losing. And you can map this out statistically. Here's another reservation I have about the way sex is handled today, and it's this, that easy sex overpromises and underdelivers. It overpromises and underdelivers. There's a really interesting correlation that you can trace in America between those who are more sort of sexually progressive, and those who are also more liberal on the political spectrum. And when you try and figure out what is the reason for that, why is it that the more left-wing people are also the more sexually progressive, you can eliminate a lot of aspects. You know, is it to do with race? No. Is it to do with age? No. You take out all these elements, and what they've discovered is that it has actually to do with religious affiliation. And the way some sociologists are speculating about this is that they thought, well, religion offers people a sense of transcendence in life, doesn't it? It puts transcendence into ordinary daily life. And that's something every person longs for, a kind of spiritual reality, you can put it like that. But when life becomes disenchanted, when transcendence has left and is bled out of ordinary life, the longing for transcendence still remains. And more, as people walk away from religion, they walk towards substitutes. And one of the greatest substitutes that people have sought is sexual pleasure. And particularly pushing the boundaries, because, of course, the more you have of sex, the more you realize that it doesn't fulfill. And therefore, you try more and more outlandish and progressive, or however you want to describe it, ways of practicing your sex life. But at root, it is a hunger for transcendence. And of course, sex can never offer you what faith in a living God can offer you. I want to speak finally about love. I think this is where probably the most interesting thing, but we need to understand that the way we understand love in its essence has also changed. The way it's mapped out by sociologists is to understand that there used to be, firstly, what they called the matrimony model of love. This is the most traditional way of understanding love and partnership, which meant that the marriage relationship may have involved attraction and romance, but not necessarily, and it could come about for all kinds of reasons. Socially convenient, or your family wanted it, desired it. All kinds of reasons brought marriages about, sometimes for love, but not always. And that when you were bound to another person, you were bound for life, and that you accepted certain roles within that relationship. So that was one model. Over the 20th century, that slipped into the romantic model of love, which sort of began to strip away some of the social expectations and praise the idea that you can marry for love, and that love is the heartbeat of marriage. But still, it looked like traditional marriage in many senses. Except that, of course, it was becoming slightly easier to leave the union. Because when the love goes, of course, then what's the reason for the marriage to continue? But more recently, and I'm talking sort of in the last 30, 40 years, what they've begun to describe is what a man called Anthony Giddens coined a term called the pure relationship. And this is basically the way, it's kind of in the air now, how we think about partnership, the pure relationship. And here's how Pastor Timothy Keller from New York describes it. He says, older cultures taught their members to find meaning in duty by embracing their social roles and carrying them out faithfully. And during the Enlightenment, things began to shift. The meaning of life came to be seen as the fruit of the freedom of the individual to choose the life that most fulfills him or her personally. That's one thing you've got to understand, is that now we believe in the individualization of society, where your life is what you want it to be, and the meaning of life is what you created, how you created. It says, instead of finding meaning through self-denial, through giving up one's freedoms, or binding oneself to the duties of marriage and family, marriage was redefined as finding emotional and sexual fulfillment and self-actualization. And so the way that this is understood now is that the pure relationship is described as pure because it exists for itself. It's not the expectations of society or anyone else. It's for you to choose to enter or to leave at will. And you enter it for as long as you discover that it gratifies you. And the minute that you discover it does not gratify you or actualize you or fulfill your individual ambitions in life, then you can leave. And this is basically the fundamental way that people understand relationships these days. It's very interesting to try and put it into words, and quite difficult to do so as well. Is there anything wrong with this? What's the harm? Well, I think when life is good, it's hard to see what's wrong with this. When you have a partner and you're both healthy and happy and employed and having fun together and both actualizing yourself, whatever that means, then sure, it seems a reasonable way to go about life, doesn't it? But love, as I understand it, is only love when it's put under stress, when it's tested. It's only love when it can survive the harshest trials of life. And you think about some of the trials that hit you when you're married or when you are in a long-term relationship with somebody. Think about the problem of sickness. I've known couples, and you know, I think particularly of one man. There was a pastor, actually, who I believe in his 20s, his wife began to deteriorate with a muscle-wasting disease, one of these congenital diseases. And essentially, he became her carer for decades until she passed away in her late 50s. What did she offer him in that relationship? In the model of the pure relationship, that man should have left her. But his marital vows, the promises, were what kept him faithful to her over decades. What about the test of when you're growing old and less attractive? You know, when you ask yourself, where does this modern obsession with youthfulness come from? I think it has a lot to do with the insecurity that's created by the way we understand love today. Because you have to look youthful in order to be desirable, and you have to be desirable in order to have someone commit to you. And this is not just my speculation, friend. Christian Rudder, who was one of the executives at OkCupid, put out some blog posts showing some of the data that they'd discovered over the years about matchings and couplings and attraction. Masses of data from their website. And one of the most interesting things was looking at what the ages that women and men find attractive when they're looking at the opposite sex. Generally speaking, when women are young, they typically find men attractive who are just a few years older than them. And that continues until they get to about 35. When they reach 35, they're about level. They're like men who are roughly their age. And then as they grow older, say into their 40s, they're like men who are a few years younger. When they're in their 50s, they're like men who are like 10 years younger. But that's roughly how it goes. It kind of you can roughly follow the trend upwards with both of them. Ask yourself, who do you think men find attractive? And the answer is, across the board, young men, old men, they find 21-year-old women attractive. Now, I say it in some ways with a kind of sense of, I almost don't want to say it. Because the last thing you want to do is make everyone here feel insecure and go home crying. But the question is, how can love survive in that model of the pure relationship where each individual is an autonomous individual who stays in the relationship for as long as they're getting what they want out of it? Because as you can see, there's an imbalance there. And that's a scientific verified imbalance. And that is a problem. Here's another test that tests your relationships. Children. I've got two of them. They mess you up. You get way less time together as a couple. Date nights for long seasons become a thing of the past. The carefree fun of just doing whatever you want when you wake up in the morning on your day off becomes a thing of the past. Your wife's body changes, and heck, your body changes too. There's noise all the time. There are expenses which cause stress, and both of you have to continually make sacrifices every single day, and usually one of you has to make more sacrifices than the other. Various seasons in parenting. And I ask myself, how many guys or girls on Tinder are signing up for that? It's hard to understand how this model of the pure relationship maps onto the realities of life. And so you might be thinking, well, does that mean that we just have to return to some older model of love? And I think we can easily identify problems with everything I've described. You know, there were loveless marriages in the matrimony model, and that's a tragedy, because marriage without love is drudgery. And then the romantic model, the whole thing was just too mushy and too fragile. And then in this pure relationship model, basically, I think they just misunderstood. I think we, in our culture at large, we've just misunderstood what love is today. I don't think we actually understand what love is in its essence. So where do we go from here? Well, unsurprisingly, I think there's wisdom and truth in an old book which has lasted about 4 millennia. And the Bible basically describes how love and commitment move in both directions. On the one hand, it says that love must move towards commitment. Obviously, we have massive problems with commitment in the world that we're in at the moment. This is why many people are struggling. It's because, and it's a hangover of looking at so many bad marriages often of our parents' generations and the examples that they've set us and the experiences we've grown up in so often in divorced homes and that kind of thing. And the people typically have come to this conclusion. They've said to themselves, I'll only marry someone who is perfect for me. I'll only marry a soulmate. Do you know that's a very, very modern way of thinking? And unfortunately, it puts upon you a crushing burden of perfectionism that makes it almost impossible to find someone to marry and to love. Women think, I want a man who's tender and romantic, who writes poetry in the evening, stays home, looks after the kids, but is also the wealthy CEO of a multinational corporation. And men think, I want a woman who is a professional journalist and a thinker and an amateur athlete and a part-time bikini model. And these expectations of the perfect soulmate paralyze us. But it's no wonder we want perfection, because we see failure everywhere around us. And we think, the only way I can make this work is if I find the match which is made in heaven. Tim Keller again puts it like this with some warmth. He says, as a pastor, I've spoken to thousands of couples, some working on marriage seeking, some working on marriage sustaining, and some working on marriage saving. And I've heard them say over and over, love shouldn't be this hard. It should come naturally. And in response, I always say something like, why believe that? Now, why is that the assumption? It seems to me that most things in life do not come without effort or work or determination. But that has become foreign to the notion of how relationships work these days. And so I want to urge and encourage you, you must understand that love has to move towards the decision to commit. Otherwise, what you have is a form of tragedy, really. Love that never blossoms or matures into commitment is a tragic thing. But here's the more surprising thing the Bible says. It also shows us that commitment generates and sustains love. I say that's more surprising. I also think it's a more beautiful idea, because we generally think of love as something passive, something that just happens to you, don't we? And as soon as it's gone, it's like, oh, you shrug your shoulders and think, well, that's it. The relationship's over, because I'm just not in love anymore. And that's why when love disappears, so many relationships crumble. Now remember that quote from Captain Corelli's Mandolin, which I read at the beginning. It ended when the description of love says it's both an art and a fortunate accident. And I think it is absolutely wrong. That is not how love works at all. Love grows and flourishes within the boundaries, even the fortress of commitment. The very choice to be committed is what makes love deep and what makes love grow tall. It's what protects and sustains love. And you ask me, well, where do you get that vision of love from? Where do you get this idea that love is nurtured by commitment? And the answer is actually in the Bible again, because the central idea that stimulates the vision of Christian marriage is the love of God towards his people. I don't want to lose you here. I know you're not all Christians, but listen to this line. This is what the New Testament tells us about marriage. It says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. And it's speaking about the fact that Jesus died on the cross, that he poured out his blood for his people, that they would be forgiven of their sins and that he would know them for eternity. So the model then of what love is fierce commitment that then produces as a result affection and love and desire. Not the other way around. So Christians, when they go on about marriage and the tradition and the institution of marriage, are not just conservative, gray-haired people who just go want to dial back to the old days. No, they're people who love the image of the man dying on the cross, demonstrating that love is self-sacrifice and not self-actualization. That love moves in the other's direction and not towards you. There was an essay written by a man called Lewis Smedes. He talked about the power of promises. And I think he captured it in one of the most beautiful paragraphs I've ever read. He says, when you make a promise, you tie yourself to other persons by unseen fibers of loyalty. You agree to stick with people that you are stuck with. When everything else tells them they can count on nothing, they count on you. When they do not have the faintest notion of what in the world is going on around them, they will know that you are going to be there with them. You have created a small sanctuary of trust within the jungle of unpredictability. You have made a promise that you intend to keep. He says promises are in fact the only way that we can control the future. And he's right. A promise kept is the only way you can guarantee what the future will look like. That is why commitment is the field in which love grows. So my question was, can love survive the dating apocalypse? I think it's a difficult answer. I think it's much, much, much harder to find love in today's climate. I think statistics show us that less of us will marry and end up partnered for life. More of us will be childless, and more of us will die alone. And that's the sad reality of the world that we're in at the moment. But I also believe the hope in this is that it doesn't have to be true for every one of us. If I can speak from the heart for one moment before I finish. For me, being a Christian is to a large degree rebelling against the cultural norms and listening to God instead. Because culture is so unstable, and I don't see much wisdom in the constant desire for change. But I feel that wisdom that has abided through the centuries and the millennia is powerful, and there's truth. And it's not only that the Christian faith is true, but that it's also livable, that it passes the test of what works in real life. When you meet suffering, when you meet trials of all kinds. And that is why I'm committed to the Christian vision of what love is. Why my wife and I intend to be together until one of us dies. And without Jesus, I don't think that would be the case. I don't think I would be that man. I'm certain I wouldn't, actually. I don't think I'd be a man who could keep his promises. But as I suggested to you a few moments ago, it's the vision of the man bleeding on the cross for me which compels me to love my wife. And I think that that's possible for every one of you to experience. Thank you.